Chapter 39. Jemiah had given up trying to contact the version of Eunice back inside the ship. She had removed her helmet and now sat with it in her lap, eyeing Geoffrey as the elevator car sped deeper into Lionheart. The suit rendered her both monstrous and comical.
"You've come a long way," the golem said, "and I don't doubt that you both have lives and responsibilities of your own. Unfortunately, you are about to get a severe case of perspective readjustment. Even the most difficult decisions you've ever had to make in your lives simply don't register on this new scale."
She was sitting with her head low and fingers laced together, looking up at Geoffrey and Jemiah as if pleading or begging.
"That was all inconsequential fluff, like choosing a brand of toothpaste."
"We've both made life and death decisions lately," Geoffrey said. "So did Hector, so did my sister."
"Decisions of strictly local consequence. If you died, your family would continue. If the family ended, that would be an economic catastrophe, but it would not be the end of all things. Do you see what I mean? Local responsibility. Contained consequences. That's not how it's going to be from now on."
Eunice looked down at her interlaced fingers. They were knitting and re-knitting nervously.
"100 years ago, more or less, I stumbled on something. It led indirectly to this moment. I've lived with the knowledge of that discovery ever since, although even I didn't grasp the full implications until decades later. Still, I knew it was something worth keeping close to my chest, and I was right about that. If I hadn't, we wouldn't be here now. We'd be a lot of dead dust and rubble orbiting the sun where once there were settled worlds and people."
She looked up sharply.
"Doubtless you think I'm exaggerating. I don't do exaggeration."
The elevator had arrived. The door opened and Eunice made to stand.
"What do you know about Mercury, Geoffrey?" she asked,
her tone turning brisk and businesslike again. "Are you talking about the falling out between Akinia Space and the Panspermian Initiative?"
"Very good. At least you're up to speed on that."
"I'm not," Jemiah said. "The Pans constructed a facility on Mercury," Geoffrey said, recording what he had already learned from Sunday and Arethusa, "to build and launch Ocula. It was a telescope, a massive one, made of tens of thousands of individual parts, floating much further from the sun than we are now. To make that happen, they needed Akinia Space involvement. A deal was cut. We'd supply the components, shipping them from Earth and the Moon. In return, we'd get to piggyback our own research outpost on the Pan's facility." He looked at Eunice, waiting for her to contradict him. Instead, she offered her palm, encouraging him to continue. "The facility needed to be on Mercury because that was the easiest place in the system to tap into lots of free energy. The Pans had already put in place a solar collecting grid to power their assembly line and launcher. We used a fraction of that energy to run some experiments in propulsion physics." Geoffrey took a moment to order his thoughts. "That was a decoy, though. The real purpose of the Mercury facility was to conduct research into Turing-level artifacts. By doing their dirty work on Mercury, my family hoped to keep away from the Cognition Police."
"The Pans knew about this?" Jemiah asked.
"No. And they weren't happy when they found out. They pulled the plug on the collaboration, booted us off Mercury. We managed to burn the evidence before the gearheads got a close look. They couldn't pin anything on us, so they went home empty-handed. That was 2085, 15 years before Eunice went to the edge of the system. At least we know what happened to one of the artifacts," Jemiah said. "What has Mercury got to do with this, here and now?"
"Ocula found something," Geoffrey said.
"Just before Eunice died, Arethusa, Lin Wei, felt enough of a debt to her friend to believe that Eunice ought to be told about the discovery. That seems to have been the trigger for something." He offered an apologetic shrug. It was as much as he'd managed to piece together.
"There's a little more to it," the golem said.
Eunice was leading them down an ice-walled tunnel. It had been bored roughly, then fixed with spray-on sealant. A walkway had been fastened to the floor, handrails and grabs to the walls, lights to the ceiling. The air was turning cold again.
Mercury was a double blind. The Artelect research was genuine, but that wasn't the sole point of our being there. The basic physics research wasn't just a screen. It was equally valid, if not more important.
She was skimming the tunnel in long, loping strides. Human locomotion, not the limb-over-limb tumble that the golem had demonstrated earlier. And looking back, smiling with uncontained pleasure. It was the delight of someone who hadn't had an audience in a very long while. She was enjoying the showmanship, her moment in the spotlight.
On Mercury, we tested a hypothesis. We constructed a relatively small-scale experimental physics facility to probe certain obscure byways of high-energy quark-quark interactions. There were bigger physics labs elsewhere, in Earth orbit, on the Moon, but we needed discretion. Above all, we had energy in abundance.
What did you find? Geoffrey asked.
What appeared to be an unpromising little side avenue that turned out to lead to something astonishing, utterly unsuspected, utterly unexplored. We'd broken through into an entire garden of new physics. We were breaching unification energies almost without trying, seeing exotic matter byproducts that shouldn't have been created since the universe was more than a couple of Planck lengths wide.
Eunice shook her head in amazement.
The wonder was that we didn't blow ourselves off Mercury. We came close in the early days. Then we dialed it back a bit and became cautious. Very cautious. It was clear that the physics we were investigating needed a bigger experimental facility.
You say we, Geoffrey said. Who else was in on this? You can't keep that kind of thing a secret if more than a handful of people are involved.
Only a handful were, Eunice said. With Artelects and robots handling the complex construction and analysis tasks, it was easy enough to run the physics facility with just a skeleton crew, and most of them thought they were working on minor refinements to propulsion design. As to who knew the full story, there were just two of us.
You were never a physicist, Geoffrey said.
I didn't say I was.
They'd reached the end of the ice-walled tunnel. The door here was as heavy and sturdily armored as a surface airlock, fixed inside a frame that was obviously well braced into the surrounding ice. It opened for the golem, and she led Geoffrey and Jemai through it. Inside was a small control room, just a couple of consoles and buckle-in seats facing three large triangular-framed windows, screened with heavy-duty slats. The wall behind them, flanking either side of the door, was lined with grey lockers and equipment racks. There was some kind of decorative sculpture on the wall to Geoffrey's right, while the one to his left was occupied by a single large display, which appeared to show Lionheart and its environs at a variety of logarithmic scales, culminating in one that was big enough to encompass the asteroid's orbit around the sun. Geoffrey's eyes tracked to the smaller orbits of the outer gas giants, then inwards to the still smaller paths of Saturn and Jupiter. Mars, Earth, Venus, and Mercury fell into an area he could easily have covered with the palm of his hand. They were a long way out. Every now and again, something would remind him of that, and the feeling was like vertigo. How could his grandmother ever willingly have sought this isolation, this sense of immense displacement from home?
It's a shame your sister isn't here, Eunice said. I'd have liked her to see this.
This was the sculpture on the wall to his right. It was a slightly irregular rectangle about the size of a Persian rug, fixed vertically against the wall. The rectangle was, in fact, a mosaic of smaller pieces, black shapes, mostly about the size of his hand, which, to judge by their jagged outlines, must once have fitted together to form a single whole. Now there were gaps and fissures where they didn't quite join, There were also entire pieces missing from the edges and the middle, bites and absences where the grey backing of the wall showed through. For all that their edges were irregular, the surfaces of the pieces, the visible faces, were as smooth as if they'd been chiselled along fracture lines. Aside from the occasional chipped or cratered piece, the dark mosaic was uniform in thickness. It gleamed with a magpie lustre, blues and greens shimmering back at Geoffrey, and within the shimmer the suggestion of faint intersecting scratches. Studying the scratches more intently, he made out what could almost have been totemic figures in cave art, a dance of headless, splayed-limbed psychopomps made up of dashes and squiggles and spirals. Would Sunday have recognized this? He wondered momentarily whether it might actually be his sister's work, but he didn't think so. With solid forms, her work tended towards the figurative. When she worked with abstract compositions, she employed every colour in the paint box.
"That would depend," Eunice said.
She had positioned herself at one of the consoles and now opened the shutters covering the main windows. They whisked away with a series of loud clunks, leaving only glass between the control room and what was obviously a very large vacuum-filled cavity inside the asteroid.
"That shielding was never going to make much of a difference if one of the reactions went critical," Eunice remarked. "But it made me feel marginally safer knowing it was in place."
They might have been looking at the interior of the drilling operation, spotlit for visitors. The cavity was impressively large, an easy kilometre across, stretching away to the left and right around a great curve, so that the far ends were not visible from their vantage point. If in fact there were ends at all, Thor, Geoffrey decided, it was just as likely that the cavity was toroidal, a donut-shaped hole dug out of the middle of Lionheart. Bolstering that suspicion was the fact that a metal tube came around the bend of the cavity, passed by the observation point, and continued on its arcing trajectory around the other end. The tube was fixed to the inner walls of the cavity by cartwheel-shaped assemblies, each shock-absorbing spoke as thick as a railway carriage. The tube itself was as wide as a major thoroughfare. Like a sated python, it bulged here and there, and secondary pipes branched out from it at various angles, plunging into the cavity wall.
"A lot of metal," Geoffrey said. 20 million tons, Eunice said, with a touch of pride. "All of it shipped up from the main belt under the pretense it was for normal mining operations. Would have been impossible if we didn't already have a massive system-wide manufacturing and transportation network in place. A few thousand tons diverted from this facility, a few more from that. Over time, it added up. But books still had to be cooked. One thing to keep a commercial secret from our competitors, another to run a secret project within the family. It took 10 years, and there were many occasions when it nearly came undone. I couldn't have done it without help. Someone to cover my tracks. Make sure there were no loose ends in the administration."
"So that's the two people who knew other than yourself," Jemai said.
Eunice smiled tersely.
"I made the initial discovery, but, as Geoffrey so kindly pointed out, I'm no physicist. Never was. I could be guided into a kind of understanding, but it was never more than a shallow approximation of the real thing."
Geoffrey asked, "How could you make a discovery without being a physicist?"
"By luck. Luck and the wit to know that what I'd found might be useful, and that I should speak to someone who might be better informed than me."
She touched a control, and the shutters slammed back into place, with the sound of a dozen rivet guns firing simultaneously.
"The experiment's powered down now," she said, "but it still gives me the flutters seeing that thing out there."
"You needed the solar grid on Mercury to run the first experiment,"
Jemai said.
"The sun's colder than a witch's tit out here. How did you find the energy?"
Eunice laughed. Not because it was a stupid question, Geoffrey decided, but rather one she liked.
"That's simple. I ran the second experiment off a small reactor derived from the first."
She moved to the black tableau on the right-hand wall,
and detached one of the fist-sized fragments. It came off easily, leaving no trace of a hook or adhesive.
"A piece of Chakra's folly," she said, tossing the item to Geoffrey.
In Lionheart's low gravity, he had ample time to catch it.
"The Phobos monolith. Your sister would have seen it, I think, on her way to the Indian settlement where I spent some time before descending to Mars."
Geoffrey caressed the black fragment, convinced that he'd already handled it. "This is a piece of Phobos."
"Something that ended up there. People have known about the monolith for at least 150 years. They saw the shadow it cast, long before they got a good close-up look at the thing itself. For a while, there were cranks who thought it might be an alien artifact. A ship, a sentinel, something like that. But when we got there, we found it was exactly what all reasonable people had always expected. A very big boulder, jammed into Phobos like a splinter. Impressive, hard to miss, a viable tourist attraction. But not an alien machine."
"Then why am I holding this?"
"I wasn't the first to see it up close, not even the 50th. By the time I got there, nearly 100 people had already come through Phobos on their way to Mars. I was the 98th, and countless robot eyes had already scanned and photographed the monolith. They'd seen it for what it was, a clearly natural feature, the result of some ancient collisional process."
Eunice waited a breath, then added,
"But they'd all missed something."
"Something you didn't," Jumai said.
"I found debris," Eunice said, "near the base of the monolith, loosely scattered over the Phobos surface material, bound there only weakly due to their low gravity. That thing had been sticking up from the crust like a target in a shooting gallery for countless millions of years. Eventually, something had hit it. Some speck of cosmic dirt and chipped off an entire face. I was looking at the debris, the shards of that high-velocity impact. Others must have realized what had happened, I suppose. But it never occurred to any of them to pay any attention to the debris."
Geoffrey was still studying the piece in his hand. "You realized there was more to it than just debris?"
"You can't have missed those fine surface markings. On the face of it, they could be anything. Spallation tracks from cosmic rays, crystalline defects, but something about them held my eye. I picked up another piece lying close by, then another. Eventually, and my suit air was running low by then, I found a matching pair. I fitted them together and saw that the scratches connected, and that they appeared to form some larger diagram."
"I'd laugh if there was any possibility you might be joking," Geoffrey said.
"I went back out there many times over the following weeks. I gathered as many of the fallen shards as I could, bringing them back to the encampment. It was easy enough to keep the pieces hidden in my personal effects, and since we were going into a gravity well and not crawling out of one, there was no mass restriction for the trip down to Mars."
"Did Jonathan know?" Geoffrey asked.
"I saw no reason to keep it from him. He was my husband, after all. And I didn't have any notion of what the scratches would actually turn out to symbolize. Obviously, their mere existence was astonishing. But beyond that, even if I went public, I couldn't see it being more than a 7-day wonder. So what if the scratches appeared to point to an alien presence on Phobos? It couldn't be proved, not rigorously. Someone could always claim that the shards had been faked by one of the first 100. And if aliens had been there, 1 million or 1 billion years ago, they'd done nothing beyond leave that one set of scratches. Like someone stopping to take a piss at the roadside before carrying on.
Graffiti. Scratched on the monolith,"
Jumai said.
"The kind of thing someone might do if they were stuck somewhere, bored, with nothing else to occupy them."
Jonathan had studied electrical engineering before making his fortune in telecoms, Eunice said. As part of his studies, he'd taken modules in modern physics. When I showed him the pieces, arranged as well as I was able, he said that the scratched forms reminded him of something. They look like little men, don't they? Or demons.
That's what I thought, Geoffrey said.
To Jonathan, they were reminiscent of Feynman diagrams, little conceptual drawings encoding the interaction histories of subatomic particles. They weren't Feynman diagrams, clearly. That would be as unlikely as finding inscriptions in our own alphabets or number systems. But they were analogous. The lines are the trajectories of particles. The squiggles are the forces mediating the reactions between them. The spirals are byproducts of those reactions. Other particles, packets of energy. That was just intuition, though. It would take a working physicist to say more than that. A good one, too. And someone I could trust. And you just happened to know someone,
Jumai said.
We established contact while I was on Mars, Eunice answered. He was fascinated by the rock drawings. He said that they already encoded the entire edifice of existing physics, as well as implying the correctness of several models that were still at the preliminary stage. What was more important, though, was that the diagrams pointed to physics we hadn't begun to probe. Quark-quark interactions that seemed forbidden on the basis of the known gauge symmetries. Do you know much about quarks? No, obviously not. Or you'd have realized that they come in three colors. Blue, red, and green. Like cheap plastic jewels. Or that when Sunday finds me reading a copy of Finnegan's Wake, there's a reason for that. I don't think we did too badly to get this far, Geoffrey said. The point was, if the diagrams were right.
Eunice shook her head, as if she was still experiencing the awe of that moment.
We could do incredible things. We could build engines powerful enough to fling a ship to Neptune in weeks. But that was just the start of it. The least dramatic breakthrough.
She smiled again.
My physicist was right, too. The engine that brought you to Lionheart was the fruit of that very early research. Really, it's just a standard Vasimir motor, with a few wrinkles smoothed out. The kind of thing we'd probably have stumbled on eventually, given enough time. But this wasn't a stumble. We saw how to make it better, and it worked. You can't know how that made us feel. We'd proven that there was testable science in the rock diagrams. But if the least dramatic predictions gave us an engine 5 times faster than anything else out there, what would we be getting into when we started to test the really frightening predictions?
You tell us, Geoffrey said.
Even with the scope of the equipment in Lionheart, we could only probe the margins of the new physics. But that was enough for now. These basic experiments have already pointed to a technology so potent that it would make the engine in that ship look like a toy.
Eunice gestured at the black mosaic.
We can do much better than that. For 150 years, we've been locked into a few hours of space around one little star. Even being able to reach Neptune in a few weeks doesn't alter that. But now we have the means to break out of the solar system. A star drive, if you will. If the physics is to be believed, then true interstellar travel is now within our grasp. Let's be clear what we're talking about here. It's still going to take a long time. A few percent of the speed of light, that's what we're looking at. Pitiful and inadequate compared to the scale of things. Horse piss against all that cosmic immensity. Even the nearest solar system will still be hundreds of years away. But that's hundreds, not tens of thousands.
She was becoming increasingly animated, as if this whole speech was approaching a carefully scripted climax.
We already think on that kind of timescale as a species. We are starting to live long enough, and we've accepted the burden of century-long endeavors like the repairing of the Earth's climate. So it's not completely abhorrent to think of interstellar travel in those terms. Of course, there's a catch.
There'd have to be, Jeffrey said. Or else why wouldn't you have gone public 60 years ago? She nodded, with what looked to Jeffrey to be inexpressible relief and gratitude, as if her most dire fear had been that he would not understand.
I said it wasn't a toy. 60 years ago, I did not think that as a species we had the wisdom to accept these gifts. Not at the end of that century, when there were still people who not only remembered wars, but had experienced them. Would you have felt any more confident in my shoes?
Jeffrey discarded the flip answer he'd been about to give. No, he admitted. Probably not.
The energy implicit in the rock diagrams would have been enough to wipe us out many times over, Eunice said. We dodged that bullet once in the era of nuclear weapons. Did we have the collective smarts to dodge it a second time? I thought not. Or at least, had such grave doubts that I could not leave matters to chance, so I didn't. I followed what struck me as the only rational course under the circumstances. I decided to sleep on matters and see what happened.
You didn't sleep, Jeffrey said. You went into seclusion for the next 62 years, or however long it was after you figured all this out. Then you died.
I didn't die, Eunice said. I just put other arrangements in place. Linwei and I might have had our differences, but I'd always hoped that Ocula would find something remarkable. When Lin came to me, when she presented the evidence of the mandala structure on 61 Virginis F, a series of processes were set in irrevocable motion. For the first time, we had a clear objective, a target for interstellar exploration. It felt right that we should also have the means to reach that target if we so chose.
But you can't decide if the time is right, Jemai said. Maybe we are a fraction smarter than we were 100 years ago. But is that smart enough? You're just an artelect. You can't possibly make that kind of choice.
I don't have to, Eunice said. I've merely passed on my responsibility. Now, it's yours.
You're not serious, Jeffrey said. Eunice's smile was not without sympathy.
I did warn you that I was about to place a heavy burden on you.
She offered her hand. Not for him to take, but to sweep majestically around the room.
All this is yours now. The experiment, the rock carvings, do with them as you will. If you think humanity deserves this gift, is ready for it, then it's yours to disseminate. Not as a commercial property, but as freely distributed knowledge. We're rich enough as it is, wouldn't you say? We can afford to give this away. If we're wise enough to deal with this as a species, then we're wise enough to deal with it collectively.
And if we don't think we're ready? Jemai asked.
Forget about what you've seen in Lionheart, or better still, destroy it. You have the resources of the family at your disposal. Shouldn't be too difficult.
Everyone's seen what the engine can do, Jeffrey said. Even if we wanted to keep this quiet, people will want to know how we did that.
Have the engine, Eunice said dismissively. Without the conceptual framework of the new physics, it's an awfully long leap from that to the star drive.
Even that small advance changes everything, Jemai said. Just being able to get out here in a few weeks rather than months is going to shake things up. The outer solar system isn't going to look so far away anymore.
So push the frontier back a little further, Eunice said. It's what I always did.
She clasped her hands.
Now, this may sound ungracious, given that you've really only just arrived, but we should begin making preparations for your return journey. I was perfectly serious about not keeping you prisoner here. That wasn't the point of this exercise.
You let us take the ship back?
Jemai asked.
After it's refueled and repaired, which, with all of Lionheart turned to the task, shouldn't take more than a week. Then you can go back into hibernation. Perhaps when you arrive, you'll be closer to your decision.
I still don't know what happened to you, Geoffrey said. I know you didn't die in the Winter Palace because there was nobody up there to die, and consequently no ashes to be brought home either. Which means that the last time anyone saw you alive, anyone we can trust, that is, was before you left for your final mission.
Linwei was kind enough to think of me, Eunice said. The least I can do is pay her back in some small measure. Remember these numbers and give them to Lin. I think they will answer at least one of your questions.
She reeled off a string of digits, then repeated them.
Lin Wei will understand.
There's one more thing, Jemai said. You talk as if you're the only person, the only thing, that knows any of this. Fine, you're an artilect. I'm ready to accept that there isn't another living soul in this asteroid. But your husband knew, and you've told us about the physicist. You've also told us that it took insider help to pull all this off without the rest of your family finding out. So we're not the only ones, are we?
My husband died a long time ago, Eunice said, long before the true significance of the rock drawings became clear. And anyway, even if he'd lived and known, I'd still have trusted him to keep it all a secret. This information will be destabilizing, whenever it's made public knowledge. And Jonathan liked stability more than anything else. That's why I left him on Mars.
And the physicist? Geoffrey asked.
He was a brilliant young Tanzanian, Eunice said. A brave and courageous thinker. But the rock drawings destroyed him. Not as a human being, but as a scientist. He'd seen too much, glimpsed too much of the inner workings of the universe, too soon, too quickly. He was a searcher after the truth, and to have it revealed to him so readily, without effort, the entire intellectual purpose of his life was undermined in one blow. Once the experiments were designed, he pulled back, left the detailed running and interpretation to the artilects.
And the insider? Geoffrey probed.
The same person, Eunice told him. When he turned his back on physics, he returned to Africa. He was a very good man, and none of this could have been achieved without him.
Then her voice softened.
And now he has died, and you must go home to bury him.